Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Spicer, and for tonight's cast, we are once again revisiting the topic of education and game design. We did this a few months ago, and we're back with part two. Part of our panel has returned, and we have a new guest with us joining us. So, let's welcome our panel for this week. First, owner and lead designer from Zachtronics, Zach Barth.
Hello.
Owner and lead designer from Serenity Forge, Z.
Hey, how's it going?
And last but not least, producer over at the University of Washington in the Center of Game Science Division, please welcome Matthew Burns.
Hello.
Hi, guys. It's great to have you all back here. For those of you who listened to the previous cast, unfortunately, Charles couldn't make it this week. He is dealing with a new type of game, raising a newborn. So, Charles, if you're listening, congratulations.
He's playing on hard mode.
Yeah, it's a hardcore mode. But let's get things rolling. So, Z, since this is your first time on the educational version of the Perceptive Podcast, I know that you were very interested in coming on after listening to our first one. So, to get the ball rolling, could you talk a little bit about your interest in education and video games?
Yeah, absolutely. You're talking about me, right?
Yeah.
Just to make sure.
Yes.
Oh, okay. One of the things that we do at Serenity Forge is that we feel like the video game medium is still so much in its infancy, and there's so much you can do with video games, not only when it comes to like artistic appeal, which you can see a lot in games like Journey. But there's a lot of value that could be driven by the medium through education and sometimes even business application or scientific research, for example. And we're really passionate here at Serenity Forge to create those meaningful experiences that that lean towards value driven experiences that aren't just playing on your phone, knocking over bricks, and wasting a lot of time and really walking away with not much value at the end of the day. So I guess that's, in a nutshell, that's kind of what we believe in and what we're passionate about. Mm-hmm.
And for those of you listening to the podcast, Z's first big Steam release was Luna's Wandering Stars, which was a physics-based puzzle game involving the planetary bodies and using different forms of physics and gravity to solve the puzzles. And I know when we spoke during the live spotlight a few weeks ago, Z, you talked about how you were trying to position Luna in the educational track and how sort of the fan base really was divided. You had a lot of puzzle fans and you had a lot of like heavy physics lovers who enjoyed the game.
Right, exactly. We had SpaceX engineers who really preferred, who really liked these games and said that they wish that they had these games when they were growing up because it was a great way for them to get introduced to physics. And they feel like if games like these were implemented in the classrooms for middle schools or high schools or sometimes even younger, then these people would be way more into physics, way more into planetary physics specifically. Whereas, the first person or the first time you ever get introduced to space physics is during your high school, like advanced level physics class nowadays, doing some pretty crazy math and calculus at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then on the completely different side of the spectrum, the SpaceX engineer completely identified the other group of people that would be really interested, which is exactly those middle schoolers who are looking at this game solely as a very addicting puzzle game. And in the meantime, they know that they're learning something new. They know that they're learning something that's important. So when they're done playing, they feel like, oh, this is so much better than a typical puzzle game out there that maybe just end up being a waste of time.
Yeah. And when we spoke in the first part of the podcast, we talked about some of the problems with getting video games into the classroom and the issues with the Common Core or the curriculum that the government requires of public schools to teach and how video games don't necessarily fit into that. We did speak about a few of the alternative schools who are using games and game development sort of as a teaching aid or a teaching variant. But for our first question then, again, Z, since this is your first time on the educational cast and you had a chance to listen to part one, were there any topics that you listened to during that cast that you wanted to share your opinion on or ask a question of the group with?
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind was the part exactly what you identified as is the How do we mash together essentially the common core values, the standardized testing together with these more educational games that don't shove education down the players' throats essentially. It's kind of like here's a very interesting example that's I would consider a quote unquote educational game, but there's no way you're ever gonna measure that in a real world setting. Is a game called Gone Home, which is a game that explores a lot of gender issues currently in our American culture, especially. My mother, who is a very traditional Chinese mom, who is also a Christian at that, very like goes to church a lot, and I found the Chinese patch for her because she doesn't really speak English, and she played through that game, and she really became a lot more open-minded about social issues and gender issues and something like that. I personally feel like she learned way more from experiencing that 2 to 3 hour game than taking a gender studies or social studies course in some kind of a high school or a college out there. How are we ever going to be able to measure that kind of a difference?
Back, Matt, any thoughts?
I mean, that's sort of less of a and that's an interesting thing, right? I mean, that's educational, but that's not school curriculum educational. So there's two different things there. The thing that kind of made me think of is, like, at that point you're describing a piece of media that is sort of maybe like a television show or a movie or a book, and that, telling a personal story that's full of, I don't know, like I don't know what you'd call that. Sort of soft, not even soft skills, because it's not a skill, right? I mean, like, having empathy for somebody else isn't really a skill.
Right.
It's more of like a just like a an emotional understanding. I don't
Yeah,
know.
awareness is one
Awareness. Yeah,
term
I
that
guess.
people use.
So, I mean, and that's a good thing about consuming all kinds of media in general, right? Is that it opens you up to different worldviews, and games are definitely good at that, right? I mean, games are just as effective as, stories, film, television, at telling stories and letting you learn about other people and their experiences.
Right, and then but however, on the other hand, you look at all these professors in the college. I mean, I just graduated from college not long ago, where you have these social studies and all that stuff. I mean, of course, there's like physics and math that is a lot more straightforward when it comes to testing. But the testing standards in these other kind of classes, you're essentially just memorizing keywords and key terms and doing a multiple choice test, and you get graded by how often you go to class. How much education is really conveyed in these classes in comparison to these video games that could, really put people in certain shoes and show them a perspective? I mean, reading 1984 taught me a lot about socialism. It's if you read it for a class, you're not going to nearly get that kind of benefit. What, playing Papers, Please taught me a lot about socialism as well. And how do you really compare all of that? And how do you standardize test? What really conveys the most amount of educational value at the end of the day?
And that's tough because it's hard to measure, and that's a big thing that in the educational industry and in the educational world, in order to be able to prove that they are educating kids, they often need to rely on a test, and so a lot is keyed off of tests, and a lot of work is done to improve test scores. But that, as he was saying, there's things that you can't measure with a test or can't measure very well with a test. And that's what a lot of critics of these kinds of efforts to standardize more, that's what a lot of critics kind of bring up, which is that just testing alone doesn't necessarily mean kids are smarter or know more or anything like that.
Yeah, I think it's this discussion is more complicated if you're talking about college level, like, social studies classes,
Yeah, of
just
course.
because you don't take tests for that, right? I mean, the way that you evaluate that is by writing essays and papers and doing research on the subject, and even then it's difficult because I think there's a greater degree of like subjectivity in those sort of fields, right? If we were talking about math. Math is just a set of objective facts, and that's different, and how games would be deployed in something like that is different.
Yeah, and that was one of the big points we talked about in the previous cast regarding how a lot of people really are focusing on teaching to these tests. When we spoke about some of our favorite educational or games that had an educational slant to them, we also talk about how a lot of them just really don't fit into a classroom curriculum. I think I asked Matt a few questions about that last time. And some of the things that he saw with trying to gain people invested or interested in using video games in the classroom. And a lot of teachers and educators, they don't see the merit of it.
Yeah, I think it's hard too, because I think to some degree, like, educational games are like vitamin water. You know, mm-hmm. they feel healthy, you know, and like, if you don't know what's going on, you might think it's healthy, but it's not, right? Like, it's sugar water, you know, it's flat soda with vitamins added to it. And I think it's easy to be like that with educational gaming, is that, like, yeah, you know, we can, you know, be upset that, you know, schools are focused on teaching tests and not playing games. But like, honestly, I don't think there's the evidence that proves that the games are a better choice, you know? And it's sort of, I guess I'm coming as this to somebody, excuse me, coming to this as someone who has made educational games and has spent a lot of time working in the space. And I kind of feel like there's a lot of people who are just saying like, oh, I like games, so therefore games are the answer,
and,
you know?
Yeah, and one of the things we talked about last time was the whole gamification craze that sort of took root about 5 years ago, and how people thought that was going to be the next big thing, was going to change all our lives. I think four of us were just completely like, nah, that didn't happen.
It didn't. Yeah. And I think it's possible that in the next 10 years, there'll be a like educational games craze. You know, it's possible it could take off, you know, but it'll probably be just as misguided. Right, because anything that catches on that big is probably bullshit.
And again, I think one of the things we did sort of agree on last time was that having a pure video game course probably won't work. Just for, as you said, Zach, that it's not really helping anyone. But if we could find ways to use video games to either supplement the learning or teach something that along the way, not exactly directly related to the Common Core, but something like maybe like a side activity, that may go a lot longer than just saying we're going to create, you know, the ultimate math video game or the ultimate game that teaches statistics.
Exactly. I mean, so we just today, we sold a perpetual site license of TIS 100, our assembly language programming game that is not educational, to a college. Because they thought that there was value in that as an activity for introducing students to the concept of assembly language in a way that's kind of fun and gamey and like very not serious. Mm-hmm. You know, just lets you kind of dive in and play with some weird assembly language programming. But like that, it's not the end all to assembly language programming education. Like, it's just a little thing, mm-hmm. right? And that's I think the reality of education is that, you know, teachers are trying to, you know, a teacher is, they have a set of kids or students, and they're trying to teach them a specific but huge set of things, and they're going to take whatever they can find that makes it easier for them to teach, mm-hmm. you know? So maybe it's a game, maybe it's a movie, maybe it's, you know, more traditional, you know, materials. But, like, there's unlikely to be some sort of silver bullet, you know, ultimate math game, and it's kind of a misguided effort to think that. And then, so then the question after that is, okay, so now what? You know, what does that mean for people who make educational games? Is like if, you know, we as an indie game studio, we make a game a year, you know, or a game every 2 years and a game every 3 years. And that's kind of standard for studios. Like, so does that mean that like you're going to make a game, like you spend 2 years making a game that acts as like an activity for one day in some science classrooms, you know, like that you're not going to be able to sell enough copies of that to cover the costs, right? Mm-hmm. Is that like, if you have something that's used in maybe like 1,000 science classrooms for like 2 days a year, like the teachers, you know, I mean, if you think about like how little, like 2 days worth of, you know, two out of, you know, like 300 days, you know, so it's like one, like at best, if they had a software budget, they could spend like 1/150th of that. You know, a typical teacher budget is on the order of magnitude of like $200 a year for materials. Like, the math doesn't work out, you know? And so I think that's why a lot of people, that's certainly why I wanted there to be some sort of silver bullet educational game thing, is because that's the only way that you could actually fund the development of educational games, if it was just so awesome that everybody had to use it. But, like, that's not what's going to happen. That's not how games work now, you know? I mean, there's a million games out there, because anybody can make a game now, and you hope to sell it to enough people that you can cover your costs, you know, while there's all these other games going on that you're competing with. And in educational space, I just sort of think that I don't think the math works out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know with you, Z, we talked on the live cast, or I think we may have talked afterwards about some of the issues that you faced with trying to get Luna's Wandering Stars in front of the eyes of educators. Were there any like interesting issues that you ran into that you would like to discuss on the cast?
It was exactly the same issues. It's measurement. Every single teacher wanted to see, especially when we pitched the idea to high schools out there, they wanted to see AP test scores. They wanted to see that mm-hmm. this game, you know, raises AP test scores by like, you know, 0.2 or whatever. And without seeing that exact number, they don't really care.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it actually would improve AP test score? I mean, what AP test are we even talking about for that? Like AP
physics.
That doesn't cover that kind of stuff, does it?
Yeah, it does.
A little bit. Specifically about gravitational. Yeah, so there is a little bit. Okay, yeah, with gravity. Yeah. Do you think that game would help? Like, especially considering that AP, if you actually encounter that, something about gravitation on the AP test, that it's going to be about formulas and solving problems, you know, analytically. Like, do you think that game would help?
Personally speaking, I absolutely believe so, but the execution is the hard part. This game, high schoolers are not going to sit down and play this game anymore by that age. You know, they have better things to do. They have to go hang out with their friends or whatever. However, if you're a middle schooler or elementary schooler, you look at a game like this, it's a lot of fun, tons of hours of fun, and parents can, you know, toss their kids in front of this game. They know that their kid is quote unquote learning.
Why does it have to be quotes?
because you're not actually learning about like the F equals MA or GMMR squared or any of that stuff. But when the kids are sitting there playing as elementary or kind of like a middle schooler kind of age, they're going to start to understand what gravity means just by playing this game. You know, you're going to know that, you know, when you want to create an orbit around a planet, you have to apply a force that's tangent to the orbit instead of just, you know, like towards the planet or something like that. That is very powerful already as it is. That's essentially rocket science in a way, where you apply force to break out of orbit or like increase orbits, elliptical strength or whatever. Those kind of concepts you only explore in a textbook setting in high school for your AP tests. You know, you have your like escape velocity, all that stuff you have to do for your AP testing. I remember doing it. I sucked at physics when I was in high school. It was like one of my worst, it was my nightmare back in those days. And personally speaking, I feel like if I had a game like this when I was much younger, I would understand it intuitively before even walking into that classroom. And when the test comes along or when the math gets applied to it, I'll understand it instantly. I'll know, oh, right, I remember when I was playing this game, I had to apply a force in that specific other direction that was not towards where I thought it was going to be. And then it just works out. So, yeah, I mean, ultimately, yes. But in order to do a test like that, you're going to have to take several years of work, really like make sure that this game is, you know, conducted in a nice, like psychological, like kind of setting where you can do that kind of testing with control groups. And that'll take several years. And it's not a team of eight people. It's not something that a team of eight people could do.
Yeah. So I used to feel a similar way, just that, you know, like we couldn't get our games in the schools because there's no way we could prove that they're helpful. But I sort of feel like now that our games don't belong in schools. You know, because there's so many better things that a teacher could do with that time to actually, you know, create a better learning outcome. And, you know, just because, I mean, there's just so many more direct ways to teach people things, especially when you're trying to teach stuff that doesn't translate well into games, like mathematical formulas and, you know, like computational algorithms and sort of like the stuff that is tested, because that is, you know, that translates into the stuff that people use in the real world when they actually have to use that knowledge.
Actually, I have a quick question in regards to that. So with TIS, I mean, I've done some assembly in the past. It's tedious. I understand just how painful it is sometimes. What kind of inspired you? You're saying that you believe that your games don't, you know, belong in the classroom anymore. But a game like that, personally, from my perspective, I feel like it'll do great in a classroom. And it'll do great outside the classroom. It's kind of like both, you know. Well, what kind of inspired you to do something like that?
I just like making games like that, right? I guess, like, if somebody wants to grab and be a game designer, then, you know, having these sort of fun experiences as a kid are super helpful. But Like, if you were trying to learn assembly language for any real reason, like, the game is probably not a good place to start. Like, what you could do something, and this is assuming that you have competent teachers, you know, who can assemble whatever materials they need, which is that you could make a fun assembly language programming course that actually teaches assembly language, and it's probably about as fun as TIS 100. Man, the reason that I think TIS 100 is great is because it's a game. It's fun. But that, like, brings me back to the vitamin water thing, right? Like, it feels like it's good for you, and it tastes great, but, like, that doesn't mean anything.
Right,
like,
right.
That's where, and then, like, the people who are selling vitamin water would love for you to believe it. You know, the people making these games would love for you to believe that they're enriching. And the fact that they're fun and enriching is, like, double awesome. But, like, when you compare it to actual things, like, that are enriching, you know, like, it's less enriching than that.
Yeah, I can key off that to talk about something that we talk about kind of in the educational space and in the academic world is that, you know, I think you're right, Z, in saying that a lot of these people who grew up to become rocket scientists would have loved to have a game like that when they were kids. But you can't necessarily use that to infer a causal relationship between playing the game and becoming a rocket scientist. You could argue that those people who are drawn to those kinds of games sort of understand those fundamental concepts already. And what you really need to be doing in education is kind of reaching out to these people who aren't already interested in math and science and people who wouldn't normally sit down in front of these types of games. And how do you get them to understand math and physics? How do you get them up to speed on these basic concepts that arguably, you know, people who are interested in these kinds of games already understand by the time that they're playing the games on their own?
Yeah, it seems like, you know, from the game designer's perspective, you know, modern day game designers or future game designers, ultimately it's maybe it's important to distinguish or not to distinguish the fact that there are educational games and there are just normal games. And ultimately, maybe it's important to kind of match the two together whenever you design any kind of video game at all. It might be just kind of from a good moral standpoint to increase some kind of educational value or secretly hide some kind of educational value here and there during all facets of game design. I think one of the important things that you guys mentioned in the past podcast was that every single game is an educational game to some regard, right? It's just a lot of game designers aren't utilizing that to the advantage of creating good with video games. And maybe we should just do that more.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly like doing that, right? I mean, that's an important part when I design games is kind of, you know, drawing from things in real life and making games that are sort of pseudo-educational. But I'm also a terrible game designer in the in the commercial sense, right? Mm. I mean, the majority of people out there making games are doing it to make money, you know? Mm. They'll do whatever makes money. Like, I don't really think highly of them and their morals.
Space Cam is phenomenal. I mean, we love the game over here. It's actually, Space Cam was one of the major inspirations for Luna's Wandering Stars when we realized that, hey, there's a lot of things you can show players through a kind of a puzzle game. So yeah, definitely don't think that way.
Well, no, but I mean, the truth though is that, like, if you compare the most of the people who are doing, like, in our industry are just doing it for money, right? And like, right. That's so I don't know. It's hard to say that, yeah, more people should be moral when, like, that's the totally an irrelevant part of most of the people doing what we do. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, then the next question would be, as game designers, is money the ultimate goal for what we do, right? That's if creating good and making change in the world is our actual goal, maybe our method of measurement for what we do is incorrect when we do it from a monetary standpoint.
Oh yeah, that's a 3-hour question right there.
Well,
yeah.
Well, that's an easy question, right? It's just that there's no such thing as game designers as a whole, right? Mm-hmm. We're all individuals who wield our abilities and preferences for whatever purpose that we're trying to, you know, whether it's a job or for personal enrichment or, you know, to have a game that lots of people love. You can't talk about everybody else.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
This is something we talked about in previous podcasts, just as a quick tangent. Every game developer in this industry has their own different path getting there. There is no one, you know, how to become a game developer guide that everyone can follow. We've spoken to developers who start, you know, they got things going right out of college. There's people who started, like, after college. One of our previous guests was a business major before he decided to open up his own game studio. So there really is no one way or even, I'm sorry, or no way to really lump everyone into one space. Because even though game developer is a title, it can mean vastly different things depending upon the person's background and experience.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. I used to work at the Federal Reserve. I mean, I was a finance guy.
All right.
You should make a game about finance.
I definitely considered it. Investment banking specifically, because I was going to work investment banking for a while, but
yeah.
Decided not to.
Yeah, you make that. That could be a social game. You could show everybody how bankrupt banking is.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
All right. Before we move on to our big topic that I want to discuss with you three, I just want to clarify one point. What you said a few minutes ago, Zach, regarding TIS 100 it's going to be featured in a college. Did the college mm-hmm. reach out to you, or did you reach out to them?
Oh, they reached out to us. So we actually sell a fair amount of, like, we used to sell nothing to schools, but as of like the past year, we've made a couple big sales to schools. And what we did was we gave Space Chem away for free to schools, mm-hmm. but you have to email me to get it. And in the process, I upsell you on everything else we've made. And the funny thing is that, like, having Space Chem available, like, because it was free, people wrote about it. And because people wrote about it, it gained credibility. And then some people are emailing us about our credible educational game. And then we're showing them ones that are way better designed and only slightly more expensive. And we've actually made a fair number of sales that way. The TIS 100 actually had nothing to do with Space Chem. That was just somebody who was like, hey, we saw TIS 100. It looks good. Sell us some copies.
Nice.
So, but it's weird. Like, it's really, I know Dan Dixon, Universe Sandbox, I talked to him about this a couple years ago. And he also sells, you know, he sells some copies to schools, but it's all dwarfed by our sales in the education or the entertainment space. It's just so much more. Right. And that if you hope to make money by selling stuff to schools, like, you are going to go out of business unless you are Pearson's or like a huge, huge educational company that already has all those connections and can sell at like a district level. And even then it's tough. You know, we made all of our educational games for Amplify, and they're a huge company, like textbook size company. And even they have difficulties selling, because even then, like, you're competing against other giant textbook companies. Yeah. And it's a nightmare. It is not a place to be, especially for indies. We can talk about tutorial stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So let's move on to our big topic. And this is what we're going to focus on for the remainder of the cast. And that is tutorials and teaching people about playing a video game. This is a major point, not just for slightly in education, like kids getting into video games, but even with adults and general consumers. We're trying to show someone how to understand your game mechanics and play. To me, this is a very underrated topic, because I've seen so many developers fail or mess up with providing a good tutorial and lesson, and it just messes everything up down the line. I can think of so many examples of games that I've played where the tutorial did nothing for me, and I was just left fumbling around trying to figure out how things work. Yep. And I definitely have some questions I want to ask the group about this topic. And I think the first question I have, I'm going to aim this over at you, Matt, since you've been doing research in terms of education and gameplay at the University of Washington. And my question for you is, have you done any research, or do you know any, that have looked at the differences between learning either through visual or like learn by doing versus like text or reading a manual? Like, is there any research about if one way is better than the other, or?
There's a lot of education research that's been done. My sense of it, you know, since I started here around 3 years ago, I've been exposed to a lot of the educational research that's happened in the academic environment. And my biggest takeaway from it is that there's tons and tons of studies that have been done, mm-hmm. and nobody still really knows a lot one way or the other, because education studies tend to have small ends, mm-hmm. Which means they've studied a small group of students. It's difficult to study very large groups of children in an educational setting. So usually they're comparing, you know, maybe 10 students in one condition to 10 students in another condition. And as a result, it's very difficult for those studies to be conclusive. You see this in studies around like video game violence, for example. There's tons of studies, but it's very difficult to tell what the result of the study actually means. You know, does it mean, like, what does becoming more violent mean? What does they learned better from They learned better by doing versus they learned better by reading. Well, how did you test them to find out if they learned better? You know, did they take a test? Did you ask them what to do? You know, like what does it mean? What does it mean when you say they learned better? What does it mean when you say they learned via book or they learned by doing? So again, sorry to like not answer your question, but I think, you know, my sense of it at least is that there is no one definitive answer to a question like that in the research that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Yeah. That was sort of the sense that I got from what I've heard and read lately is just that like it doesn't really matter what form information comes in. That's not really the deciding factor in how well people engage with it and learn from it.
Okay. And as a quick aside, that's one of the things we talked about in the previous, as again, going back to trying to show the educational merits of video games, is that the studies are just too small. And again, there's just too much variability. You can't say that 20 kids are going to represent, you know, every child in the United States. It's just impossible to compare the two.
Right. Yeah.
So here's the next question for the group then. Do you learn better either by learning by doing or visual? Or by, you know, reading a guy, the manual, etc. And we'll start with Zach, and we'll just go down the line.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't have the data to back it up, but I'm pretty confident that everybody learns by doing. Mm-hmm. It's just that doing doesn't always mean, like, physically manipulating something. But, like, you learn by exercising, like, the paths of what you're trying to learn. And that's my understanding of it. I mean, maybe it's sort of biased because I'm working entirely in the game space where games are all about doing, right? Mm-hmm. So at least for games, I think that the only way to teach people is by letting them do it.
Okay. And Z?
I feel like it depends a lot on the subject itself. I mean, I remember my chemistry courses back, you know, years ago where we have labs and, you know, you grow bacteria and then you move the DNA from one bacteria to another. And then you're like, oh, look, it glows in the dark. And I'm just like, okay, I don't know what happened. But then, you know, when you explain it in a classroom kind of setting, like, oh, okay, I get it, you know, DNA replication, RNA, and all that stuff. So, like, ultimately, when it comes to, like, really detailed technical stuff that sometimes isn't perceptible by the human, like, human nature, essentially, maybe, you know, by reading it, it would make a lot more sense. Like, for example, black holes, you know, reading about black holes will make a lot more sense than actually experiencing one, I'm sure. But yeah, I mean, then it comes down to, like, you know, what about playing basketball? What about playing a card game? How do you teach someone how to play Hearts, right? Usually what I do is just like, oh, hold on to these cards, I'll just tell you how to play, and like as we go along, because it just makes more sense that way.
Okay.
And when I say learn by doing, I don't mean like just merely like physically participating in it, but like sort of actively mentally participating in the thing you're trying to understand. So I think you're totally right. Like the lab, you know, labs were hands-on and were often really poor learning experiences because the only thing that teaches you is lab protocol and how to do an experiment. It's not going to teach you the underlying concepts. There's no way it could. Like that's physically impossible, you know? Like it's not you don't learn by osmosis just because you touched it, you know?
Yeah.
That would help out a lot though, if that was true.
And that's what bugs me about like the whole like which style of learning, you know, what kind of learner are you? Because like they're really it's like really a surface level understanding, which is not sufficient. Sorry, go on, Matthew, your turn. You haven't said anything and you're almost done.
Oh no, that's fine. I mean, yeah, I definitely learn best by trying and failing and trying again, personally. Yeah. I don't really have a lot to add to that.
So I think the thing that's interesting too in this discussion is that the way that you, like when you think about school, you know, the way that you know that you learn something is by proving it, right? Mm-hmm. And so the, like, although like your understanding of something may be a non-skill, like it's not something that you do, when you're taking a test, that's something you do. Or when you're writing an essay, that's something you do. So in the context of school, it all boils down, like the only thing they measure is your ability to do things, which is sort of a case for making it all learning by doing. You know, if you're going to take a test, like take practice tests to get ready for the test. And I think that's why you see so much teaching to the test and whatnot, is that they're saying like, hey, like if the only thing that matters is doing well on a test, you know, we need to teach the students how to take the test because that's the activity that we're trying to actually teach them because that's the actual activity we're going to judge them on. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I think this is going to loop back into games, but ask your next question, Josh.
All right. So my next question, and I think this one's going to be for you, Zach. As we talked about, your games are definitely up there in terms of challenging gameplay and definitely in terms of complexity. When we talk about Space Chem, it's a game that is about understanding the philosophy of programming using chemical elements. And then there's, of course, as we said, TIS 100, which is literally a game about programming in assembly language.
Yeah.
So my question then for you is, when you're approaching like your games in terms of someone who's never played them before and you're trying to educate someone how to get into them, how do you approach teaching someone your games, considering just the high-level thinking that's required to play a game like TIS 100 or Infinite Factory or, of course, Space Chem?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this earlier when we were just starting, and the thing that I think kind of occurred to me is that a lot of games have terrible tutorials.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about how it's challenging. A lot of games have terrible tutorials and scaffolding and learning experiences, but they get away with it because everybody already knows how to play those kinds of games.
Yeah.
You know, or they're just not that hard. And mm-hmm. for us, we don't really have that luxury because our games are mostly puzzle games, always challenging, always novel. That's like the worst situation. Like that's when you need a good learning experience in your game because people don't know how to play it. And if they stumble around, they're going to stumble around in the dark and it's full of knives, you know?
Yeah.
So for us, I mean, it's just create a good learning experience. And I don't think that our games are amazing at that because A, I think the bar is really high, and B, like, we don't have that much experience doing it. Definitely don't have, I don't have that much knowledge in like kind of like formal educational models and how to design really good stuff. But I think we've learned a lot of tricks along the way. And that's sort of just what we just try to refine our educational experience from game to game. The Space Chem had basically none. You know, we hadn't really thought about it at all. So we just did sort of the obvious, like, oh, other games have you like follow instructions for like how to play like a sample level. We'll do that. Other games have lots of text that explains stuff. We'll do that. Both of those were huge mistakes.
Mm.
You don't want to show people tons of text because reading takes a lot of effort, and reading isn't even a good way to transfer information, especially when it's about like systems and visual stuff. Like text doesn't really work sufficiently.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely don't want to have instructions that walk people through doing stuff. I think maybe like for stuff like navigating a menu, that's a good thing because it'll show you where stuff is in the menu. But in terms of trying to understand why you're doing something, those kind of tutorials absolutely fail because you're not engaging the part of your brain that's actually thinking. And so since our games are not merely about navigating through menus, but more about like thinking in terms of these systems, what we like to do is something more like traditional education where we scaffold all of the information we have to teach you. You start with something small and then mm-hmm. you add on concepts and build up off of it, and allowing people to make these little leaps like one at a time. And we always put you in these environments where you don't have to worry about the stuff that's going to come later. We're just going to focus on one thing at a time, hopefully introduce just one new concept at a time, and then put you in an environment where you're going to figure out on your own that new mechanic, but we're going to arrange things such that there's a very good chance that you're going to figure that thing out. So maybe that includes like having a hint, like a one or two word hint that you can't not read. Maybe a little diagram, maybe just laying things out if there's like a spatial element. Like that. And then from there, iteration, right? TIS 100. So TIS 100 is notable because it doesn't have a tutorial. It specifically has a 14-page manual that we tell you to print when you start the game instead of a tutorial. But we actually still had problems where people didn't, they were sort of, like, people are okay with that too, because that's like part of the game. But people were getting confused that like, they don't know what they're supposed to be doing. And the manual explains how the machine works, but it's not a game manual. It's a manual for this like puzzle machine, this computer that you're using in game. So people didn't know like, oh, you can click in the boxes and type in code, and if you hit run, your code will run, and it'll take these values in this input column and move them to the output column. And so we did actually have to add a tutorial in the form of a first level where one half of it is solved with a simple puzzle, and then there's sort of a slightly harder puzzle on the other side that you have to solve. And it doesn't teach people how to play. It doesn't teach people like how to write a program. Well, I guess it doesn't teach people how to write specific programs that you'll find later on, but it does teach you the idea it teaches you what your goal is.
Mm-hmm.
It teaches you the general way in which you accomplish it, which is by entering text. So it is a tutorial in that regard.
Yeah.
And so sort of that's how that would be applied to a game like TIS 100.
Yeah. I'm glad that you brought up the difficulties with trying to teach someone through just a lot of text when you're talking about systems and mechanics. Because that goes back to what we were saying a few minutes ago regarding the lab experiments and how if you're doing like a simple lab experiment in high school, that doesn't teach you chemistry. As you said, it just teaches you the protocols. You're,
exactly.
you're being taught that specific circumstance and those set specific rules. That's not going to help you if someone says, okay, now, you know, mix something completely different. You don't know what that is because you were only taught, you know, how to do X, Y, and Z in this one specific condition. And that is one of the things that I find very annoying about a lot of strategy games, especially like the 4X and grand strategy genre, where they try to teach you again through these very simple scenarios that really don't give you any real information about how these mechanics and systems work in the greater sense of the game. Again, yeah. you're just learning, okay, I'm pressing this button here, I click this three times, but why am I doing this?
Yeah. Why is this a good strategy?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually just picked up a hex-based strategy game that looked kind of simple. I'm like, I'm totally going to play this. I've always wanted to play a hex-based strategy game. And it just dumps you into, like, it does a little tutorial, and it dumps you into the game. And I don't know why I'm doing it. Like, I don't understand the strategy of it. And in that regard, the tutorial didn't really work.
Yeah, and that's actually a good springboard for this next question for the group. For the three of you, and I'll even chime in here, are there any specific genres or even games that you've played that just for the life of you, you can't learn or figure out? These are those games that no matter what happens, you can play other games well, but these are ones that they just completely stump you. And this time I'll go first. For me, as I said, it's definitely the grand strategy 4X super genre. You know, the Europa Universalis, Crusader Kings, pretty much anything by Paradox Software. If it's a strategy game by them, usually I can't figure that out. And the other thing would probably be like super complex simulator type games. Flight Sims. I've been staring at my copy of Kerbal Space Program for months now, just afraid to load that up because I have no idea what I'm doing there. And again, it goes back to what we were just talking about, that these games, again, they teach you in these scenarios, but they don't teach you the greater mechanics or thinking behind what you're supposed to be doing. And this time, let's start with Matt.
A genre of game that I'm really bad at and that I've never been able to sort of wrap my brain around is fighting games. Whatever reason, like just memorizing combos and being able to consistently pull off a combo and kind of understanding where the hitbox is and where the damage frame is and you know how many frames it takes for a punch to connect versus and so on, and you know, knowing when to block and what type of block and all that kind of stuff. I appreciate their complexity, and the more I learn about them, the more interesting they seem to me, but I'm really unable to put that together into a coherent play style or anything like that. So I'm very poor at fighting games, and I just don't understand them well enough to be able to be good at them, I don't think.
Yeah. And as a quick aside regarding the fighting game genre, that's one of the things that we've seen a lot, because a lot of fighting games really didn't teach you about those greater concepts. They just deal with the surface level of, you know, input a combo, you shoot a fireball.
That's right. Yeah, a lot of them just throw you in and you're supposed to understand all this stuff that they have. And they have, you know, they have all these meters and they have these meters that you build up over time and you don't know what builds them up. And then once it's built up, you have to know the combo to unleash the move and stuff like that. And it's not, you know, it's not tutorialized or scaffolded at all.
Yeah. I would say, not only for you, Matt, but for anyone else listening, if you're looking for a very good example of a fighting game tutorial, the game Skullgirls had one of the most comprehensive tutorials I've ever seen from the genre.
It basically, does it teach you about all the hidden stuff?
Yeah, it goes down the entire list. It teaches you all the mechanics. It teaches you what things do. And then it goes move by move for every character. So it tells you, okay, this character does this, this, and this. This would be an anti-air attack if you do this. And it's basically like a fighting game 101 tutorial. It was one of the best ones I've ever seen, even in all the years. And like the complete opposite would be stuff like Mortal Kombat, where again they just tell you what the buttons do, but they don't tell you, you know, what does his attack do, why you should do this, how do you even build up your meter. I still don't know a lot of that stuff, and I get my ass kicked online because of it. But definitely Skullgirls is a really good example of a fighting game tutorial. But let's move on. Next person. So Z, you're up.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's kind of surprising for me to say this. I love tactical RPGs. The Fire Emblem series mm-hmm. is probably one of my favorite. It's what got me into gaming, actually. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you recently picked up Valkyria Chronicles on Steam. It was an amazing game. Really like the tactical strategy kind of atmosphere when it comes to games. But I just can't get into board games at all. Mm-hmm. Like especially... So this one time we were doing research on, so we were working with this other team, potentially doing some kind of a contract work for them to turn one of their board games into a video game format. And the game is similar to like FTL, which is a good strategy game out there, and which is a game that I really enjoy playing. Mm-hmm. And it has the hex grids and everything. So we're like looking at this game and we're sitting in the office like, okay, how do you play this game? So we look at the guide, and I spent like half an hour reading through this guide trying to figure out what is going on. And once I figured it out, we put it in action, and then we played for like maybe 10 minutes, and then I realized that, oh, that's it. Like, this is it. Like, I spent like a good half an hour reading this novel about how to play this game, and then like this game's design is like way worse than I expected, and it's just not fun to me compared to something like Fire Emblem that's way, way better designed, I feel like, and all of the fun is just like rolling dice and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like I just can't get into those games. I think especially being brought up with more computers and more RNGs inside the computers that does mm-hmm. the dice work for you, you just don't really, at least I don't really feel that much enjoyment in like rolling a die and yelling at my friend's face when I get something good.
Yeah, I never got into board games just because I never had people to play them as a child. I've never even played like any pen and paper games. I've only played like Settlers of Catan like once in my entire life. And again, it just didn't interest me. I think I'm the same way as you, Z, that I grew up with video games. I grew up with a lot of things handled by the AI and the abstraction. And to like sit down and put everything on a giant table, just, it really doesn't interest me, I think.
Yeah, it's a waste of time, it feels like.
And for you, Zach?
Tycoon games.
Ah.
I understand the premise, but I don't know what the point is. And I've never, like, they've all failed, like, If it's to succeed in a business sense, I never do, because I have no idea like what it expects me to do or how to do it. And it's, you know, I know how to build a building is another perfect example where they explain like the physical, like surface level controls, but they completely fail to explain the motivation for why you're playing or sort of how to accomplish it. I mean, that's tough, right? Yeah. I think it's better than having to explain stuff. And explaining it well is making it so you don't have to explain it. And so on your fighting game thing, I think a great example of an even better fighting game is Divekick. Because they didn't explain the stuff well. They got rid of it. So you don't have to know any of the stuff. It's just like you can just figure it out intuitively because it's simple. You know, it's simple enough.
Right. It's very simple. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly simple.
Yeah.
But it's still complex. Yeah. Or it's not complex, but it's you know, it gets interesting. I mean,
it's complex in its way. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For sure.
Zach, have you played like anything like Prison Architect or like those types of games that like more like modern examples of like the tycoon management games?
No, all the ones I played were the older ones.
Okay. Prison Architect is interesting because it has that same problem that you were just describing, that it teaches you, you know, buildings go here, you know, this goes there, but it doesn't tell you why you're really doing that. And that's a whole nother discussion about management and even like city building design. But it does, to sort of start to wrap things up, it does lead back into what we talked about with tutorial design and how the best tutorials are those that, as we said, it teaches you gradually in these mechanics, so you're learning how things work within the context of the game. When you're separating these elements, or you're just explaining with, you know, 20 pages of text, it doesn't really work because you're not teaching them within what exactly is the situation. And I guess here's one other question I just want to ask quickly to you, Zach. In terms, as we said earlier, Space Chem was a very complicated game. A lot of people didn't get far into it. With Infinifactory and TIS 100, are the metrics like any better? Are people getting further into those games than they were in Space Chem?
So Space Chem, I think probably the reason people didn't get very far is because it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really difficult, yeah. You know, the stuff that we expect you to do because that's the meat of the game. Mm-hmm. It's very challenging, and it's interesting because people's ability, like if you take like a huge group of people and have them play it, you're going to see wildly different outcomes. Some people are just going to understand it, and some people are just not. And I don't think it's just like random, like whether they read the right words in the tutorial. It just has mm-hmm. to do with like whether they're primed for that kind of systems yeah. thinking. Like that's one of the, I think one of the more difficult things to do. Like non-physical things that you can do as a human being is solve complex problems mm-hmm. like that. So with InfiniFactory, we just made it easier. And yes, people have gotten further because of it.
Oh,
the right. tutorial is better too in InfiniFactory, right? Like it's mm-hmm. scaffolded, so that way you only have to learn one thing at a time, yeah. which makes it easier to learn by accident. And we use visual aids instead of text.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We made IKEA diagrams because IKEA is a great example of mm-hmm. tutorial design, right? They teach you how to build the furniture. You don't know how to build furniture, but they make it really easy, and they make it so it doesn't have to be localized.
Yeah. Yeah. So this has definitely been a great cast. Again, with this topic in terms of education and teaching people how to play games, we could really sit here for like the whole afternoon, probably most of the night, talking about it. But I know that you guys are busy. For those of you listening, Z is in the middle of a thunderstorm right now, so I don't want him to get knocked out. A few weeks ago, and from the time of this recording, we had a tree that literally got uprooted out of the ground and crashed down the street and knocked out all the electricity for like 8 hours.
Oh,
wow.
And we had basically like a giant, like, the tree basically made like a barrier, no one could get out of the street from that part of the road. It was just insane. Like nothing like that has ever happened. But yet, I don't want Z to be stuck there during a thunderstorm. So we'll begin to wrap things up. So my first question then for the three of you, regarding this final topic in terms of tutorial design and teaching someone how to play a game, do you have any final thoughts or any you would like to add just on that topic?
Maybe one thing that I would like to say to all of the game designers that are listening to this is that there is some interesting educational research that's taken place about tutorials and tutorialization. Mm-hmm. For example, at the Center for Game Science, we've done some work around teaching kids how to solve certain math equations, right? Mm-hmm. There are certain math operations that you do that are highly procedural and take a certain procedure that needs to be taught. For example, long division or doing one of the quadratic equation, expanding a quadratic. Those kinds of things. Those are highly procedural techniques that you need to learn how to do in math class. One interesting thing that you can do using kind of game-related technology is build an interactive tutorial that dynamically sort of tutorializes the procedure. So you encode the procedure in its full form in some sort of way, and then make kids try to do the procedure, and the tutorial only steps in when the procedure is not being followed correctly or if a mistake is made.
Is there a paper about that?
Yeah, there's multiple papers on it, and I can send you guys the links yeah. to them. But this is called intelligent tutoring. It's an area of active educational research, and I think it's tremendously exciting, especially from a game design perspective. Imagine you're playing a game, and the game only teaches you the things that you need to know how to do. It doesn't, you know, when you start a game and it's like, press square to attack for light attack, and, you know, use the right thumbstick to move around, and it's like, you already know those things. But if there's some special thing that you don't know how to do, it would be able to tutorialize that. Okay. So intelligent tutoring is a really interesting field of research. It builds a model of what you know, and then it tries to give you stuff that is just above your level to add to your knowledge. So it's not teaching you stuff you already know, and it's giving you just the right educational intervention when it's needed the most. That's the theory, anyway. It's an area in active research, so the jury's out on whether that will be an extremely successful technology or not. But I think it's definitely interesting to look into. And if you're a game designer and you're thinking about how to tutorialize your game, that's something to think about.
Okay.
Yeah. There was another paper that you guys wrote. It was an older one about tutorial, like what kinds of tutorials are effective in games. And that
That's
wasn't
right.
even
yes.
it wasn't even specific to educational games. It was just tutorials and games. And that was like a huge thing for us in our understanding of tutorials. Like basically everything that we do now, we learned from that paper.
I can send you a link to that paper as well, Josh, if you want to reference that in your show notes.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, yeah, definitely send that over, man. I will really be interested in that. And just to clarify the point on the CAS, so this kind of tutorial would be basically while you're playing the game, it would only pop up messages and information if you get stuck at a part, or it will just wait to see what you're doing and then send you relevant information about what you need to know.
Yeah, I mean, it could potentially do either of those things.
Okay.
Since the whole idea behind intelligent tutoring is it sort of monitors what you do, and it figures out what you understand and what you don't understand.
Okay. Yeah, definitely send that over. I think that'll be interesting, including the podcast notes. So, for Zach and Z, do you have any final thoughts on the topic you'd like to share?
I shared all mine earlier.
Yeah, pretty much. When it comes to tutorials, the only thing that comes to my mind, or at least the first thing that comes to my mind, is Sequelitis, Eagle Raptor's episode on YouTube about how Mega Man X treats how to teach a person how to play a video game, which I think is the most hilarious video and also a very scientific video in itself, and probably my favorite YouTube video of all time. And so, you know, that episode just shows so much things that you could do that, you know, all it does is takes a little bit more effort from the game designer's perspective to show the players or, you know, design levels that would make it a lot more intuitive in terms of gameplay rather than just, you know, putting, you know, words in front of the screen and telling them how to do it.
Yeah.
So I've also seen that video and I like it, but my beef with it is that it doesn't explain how to do it as a game designer, right? Because it makes it look really hard. Like, oh, they were so smart for making this level that perfectly teaches you. No, the really easy way that anybody can do that is you do a million playtests of your first level while watching over someone's shoulder while they do it for the first time. Mm-hmm. And you do that, you analyze what did they not learn, what did they learn? And then you tweak it until, like, you add more scenarios to your first level that will allow them to discover the things that they didn't learn. And you do that over and over and over and over and over again. And then eventually you'll have this level that geniusly, you know, like teaches emergently all of the things that you want somebody to learn, but it's not because you're smart, it's just because you were persistent.
Mm. I mean then you can look at, I remember when I was trying out Batman Arkham Asylum, I was never able to get into the Batman games solely because of the tutorial. Like, I remember when I first started that game, I was like, I really don't need to read more text right now. And it just keeps on giving me more and more text. And I just got so tired of it, I ended up stopping the game after 10 minutes.
And as a good example of that type of learning through level design, I made a post about organic level design, just about what we were just saying, teaching the player through the mechanics and design level. And it is very hard to do that. The example that I like is the original Super Mario Brothers World 1-1.
Yep.
And how they taught everything just through how they place all the items and mechanics. And that's definitely something that I think a lot of developers really need to look at in terms of trying to build that level. But as you said, Zach, it's very hard to explain that concept to someone because it really is just about iteration,
yeah,
to get it just right. But I think with that, we will wrap things up. It has been a great part two. Hopefully we can come up with some more topics and maybe have a part three at some point in the distant future. So to end things here, again, Zach, Matt, Z, it's been a pleasure talking to you this afternoon. Hopefully, Z, you'll still have power tonight. Everything will stay on for you. But yeah, it's been great talking to you three.
You too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, thank you.
Yep, not a problem. So, again, this has been another great cast. As I said, if we can come with some more topics for a part three, I would definitely like to do more because there's definitely a lot of avenues we can talk about in terms of education and game development, just teaching someone about design and mechanics. But that will hopefully have to be for another time. So for those of you listening, this is going to end things here for this educational edition of the Percepta Podcast. As always, if you'd like to contribute to GameWisdom, we have several options currently available. If you would like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest for any number of topics, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. To contribute to our ongoing Patreon campaign, to secure some much-needed monthly funding to keep all this going, you can find me on Patreon under Josh Beister or Game-Wisdom, and there is the Patreon banner also on the front page. Any donation will be greatly appreciated there. And finally, if you would like to check out my live streaming of playing video games and talking about the design, or just the general playthrough, you can find me on Twitch nightly around 10 Eastern under GW Bicer, and all the videos will be uploaded to the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. So, again, thanks everyone for tuning in, and thanks Zach, Z, and Matt for coming on this great afternoon. And those of you listening, have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.